Hello and welcome to Podiatrics Pediatric Podcasts. Today we're going to be, as a follow-on from our adrenal insufficiency podcast, we're going to do a bit of a quiz. So this is going to focus around a case report that was published in the British Medical Journal last year. I'm going to outline some of the important points for this case, and we'll go through it, and then we've got basically 10 questions to follow that should help reinforce whether the podcast on adrenal insufficiency has been effective. So the case that is illustrated is that of a 10-day-old male infant presenting to the emergency department with a 3-day history of poor feeding and lethargy, no fever or irritability. Born at 40 weeks gestation by emergency C-section with no complications. Apgars of 7, 9 and 9 at 1 minute, 5 minute and 10 minute. Birth weight was 2.80, so on the 2nd to 9th centile, and a length of 49 centimetres on the 25th centile. Head circumference was 36 centimetres, that's between the 9th and the 25th centile. So that's your first paragraph. So how you can decode that 10-day-old male infant, poor feeding and lethargy. And birth weight was 2.80. So on the 2nd to the 9th centile, so on the lower side. Length on the 25th centile, so slightly better. And a head circumference between the 9th and the 25th. So antenatal history, normal scans, normal maternal serology for infections, and no risk factors for sepsis. First child of consanguineous parents, so their first cousins. Had an older brother who was apparently healthy, no chronic diseases that run in the family. So the thing that you would take from that is they're at risk of autosomal recessive conditions, because if you're consanguineous, the chances of both of you carrying a certain mutation are higher. So they're at risk of autosomal recessive conditions. So we've got a child, male infant, who has got a history of poor feeding and lethargy and has got an increased risk of autosomal recessive conditions. But we'll read on. So on initial examination, crying and alert but bradycardic. Okay, so a heart rate of 65, but in a 10-day male infant is definitely bradycardia. Sunken eyes and slightly depressed anterior fontanelle. So the significance of that is dehydration. So autosomal recessive, okay, because of the consanguinity, bradycardia and dehydration. Respiratory rate was 50, saturated 99% on air. Pre and postductal saturations were 98 and 97, so there's not a significant difference. And he's got a 2 out of 6 systolic MIRM in the pulmonary area. So this could be pulmonary stenosis, could be peripheral pulmonary stenosis, most likely. Examination of the respiratory system and abdomen were normal. Okay, so the first thing that we need to look at is dehydrated and has got bradycardia. Okay, so what do we do? Well, first of all, the bradycardia. So blood pressure was 92 over 56. That's above the 50 centile. So is not hypotensive with this bradycardia. Blood gas, however, pH of 7.30. So our normal's 7.35, 7.45. So acidosis. Okay. Acidemia. Bicarbonate 16.1. So this looks like a metabolic acidosis. Base excess minus 9, that makes us think this is most probably a metabolic acidosis. Sodium's 112 when it should be between 135 and 145, so low sodium. Potassium is 9.7 when the upper end of normal is 5. Ionized calcium's within normal limits, glucose is within normal limits, and lactate is up at 3.3 when it should be less than 2. So what I want you to do is, first of all, before we delve into the questions, I want to have your impression about what you think might be going on. So just collect that information and try and put it in some sort of context. I may help you by saying that this patient has got, it looks like anyway, a non-anion gap metabolic acidosis. So metabolic acidosis with a normal anion gap. So as I think is really appropriate in these cases with an elevated lactate and acidosis, he was initially treated as per sepsis. So was given amoxicillin and in this case kefotaxime. So the results of the blood gas prompted a re-examination of the genitals, had normal male genitalia, but the pigmentation of genitalia was noted to be darker than the infant's otherwise skin tone. So what do you think? So my first question is, what do you think the likely diagnosis is in a best of five question? So that's my first question. So the most likely diagnosis is he'd be treated for suspected sepsis, but the most likely diagnosis in this case is congenital adrenal hyperplasia. Why do we say that? Congenital adrenal hyperplasia is something that needs to be considered in this case because of the poor feeding and lethargy, that's how this condition can present. The consanguinity, it's inherited as autosomal recessive. Bradycardia and dehydration with the low sodium and the high potassium implies there's salt wasting, and more so than salt wasting, you've also got salt wasting and hyperkalemia. So that would imply that you are not producing enough aldosterone, and the non-anion gap metabolic acidosis, something you can see in hypoaldosterone states. So you can see it in things like type 4 renal tuber acidosis, you can see it in Addisonian pictures, and you can see in congenital adrenal hyperplasia when you've got mineralocorticoid deficiency. The genitalia that is darker than the rest of the skin, and the hyponatremia and hyperkalemia, again with a suggestion that it's autosomal recessive with the parents that are cousins of each other, points towards congenital adrenal hyperplasia. So the likely diagnosis is congenital adrenal hyperplasia. Remember, that is a description of a group of conditions. The most likely diagnosis would be 21-hydroxylase deficiency. And this patient was given intravenous fluids, steroid replacement, and was treated as congenital adrenal hyperplasia. And that was confirmed on genetic analysis. Why is the potassium high and the sodium low is question number two. So why is the potassium high and the sodium low for question number two? So the answer for question number two is asking yourself the question, what's the physiological function of aldosterone? So aldosterone leads to sodium reabsorption and potassium excretion. So if you haven't got enough aldosterone, you get potassium retention and sodium excretion. So aldosterone normally causes you to reabsorb sodium, water follows, and you get an increased blood volume and increased blood pressure, and kicking out of and getting rid of potassium. You get the opposite then if you haven't got enough aldosterone. So rather than you reabsorbing sodium, you waste sodium, so you pee it out. And rather than getting rid of potassium, you retain it. So that's the answer to question number two. Question number three, why have we prescribed both fludrocortisone and hydrocortisone in this patient? For question number three, the reason we've prescribed both is because this is primary adrenal insufficiency, so we replace both of them. If it was secondary adrenal insufficiency, we would just replace the cortisol with hydrocortisone, and we wouldn't worry about the fludrocortisone, it's the aldosterone replacement, because the RAS system would be functioning normally. Question number four, what is the most common enzyme deficiency in congenital adrenal hyperplasia? 21-hydroxylase deficiency is the answer for question number four. It's worth remembering that if we see a patient with a non-anion gap metabolic acidosis, for example, that we saw in this case of 21-hydroxylase deficiency, we talk about the three buckets of normal or non-gap metabolic acidosis. So basically metabolic acidosis with a normal anion gap. Think about chloride intoxication, the most common cause of that is giving patients loads of normal saline. The second thing is gastrointestinal loss of bicarbonate, such as diarrhea or surgical drains. And the third thing that we're talking about in this case is renal loss of bicarbonate. That's normally renal tuber acidosis when you're losing bicarbonate and therefore become acidotic. Before we move on to question number five, I wanted to mention why potassium changes according to your pH. So you'll be aware of that with acidosis, so for example, someone with who comes in with diabetic ketoacidosis before you give them insulin, they may well have hyperkalemia. Patients that are septic may well come in with a high potassium level. And with alkalosis, things like, for example, pulmonary embolisms, etc., and other conditions where you become alkalotic hyperventilation, you may actually have your potassium being lower. The frequent mechanism that people talk about is that acidosis causes potassium to move from cells to your blood in exchange for hydrogen ions. So they go in both directions. So basically, acidosis causes your potassium to move to the plasma, and alkalosis causes the reverse movement of potassium. And it's an exchange mechanism. So you're exchanging a positively charged ion potassium for a positively charged ion hydrogen. So you exchange the two. So acidosis, when your causes your potassium to go up, and alkalosis causes your potassium to go down. It's kind of a frequently cited mechanism. So more recently, in 2018, there was a mechanism actually that they think that hyperkalemia decreases the ability of your proximal tubule to generate ammonia and actually impacts on ammonia transport. So I actually think that it's an impairment of ammonia excretion that causes the metabolic acidosis and derangement of potassium. Fine. So question number five is, in which layer of the renal cortex is aldosterone produced? Okay. Question number six is, in which layer of the renal cortex is cortisol produced? And question number seven is, in which layer of the renal cortex is DHT produced? So if we look through those one by one, okay, our first question was aldosterone production is in the zona glomerulosa, so that's GFR, salt, cortisol in the fasciculata, which is sugar, and then DHT is in the reticularis, or R. So that's GFR. So the answers for 5, 6 and 7 is aldosterone, glomerulosa, cortisol fasciculata, DHT reticularis. Remember that your medulla secretes your catecholamines such as adrenaline, noradrenaline and dopamine. Okay, so that's question 5, question 6 and question 7. I'm going to mention as a potential learning point, those of you that are interested, is the most common type of congenital adrenal hyperplasia is 21-hydroxylase deficiency. The second most common is 11-beta-hydroxylase, in case they set higher questions to distinguish between candidates. And the way that you can principally distinguish between these two is actually your mineralocorticoid synthesis goes up in congenital adrenal hyperplasia due to 11-beta-hydroxylase. 11-beta-hydroxylase deficiency converts, well, the enzyme itself converts 11-deoxycortisol to cortisol. So actually, if you've got a deficit, you can't produce cortisol, but then you get accumulations of these steroids with mineralocorticoid activity and overproduction of androgens. So very similar presenting in exams, but you won't get a metabolic acidosis in this condition because your mineralocorticoids will be fine. So you won't get a metabolic acidosis. You may, if it's really severe, get a metabolic alkalosis because you'll have too much bicarbonate potentially, but you won't get a metabolic acidosis. You would get more a Kohn syndrome metabolic acidosis picture. So that's how you can distinguish between them. Metabolic acidosis and high mineralocorticoids in 11-beta-hydroxylase. Okay, so no metabolic acidosis in 11-beta-hydroxylase, but increased mineralocorticoids, 21-hydroxylase deficiency, metabolic acidosis plus mineralocorticoid deficiency. So we've done 5, 6, and 7. We've got 8 in the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis, which two are functioning in Addison's disease. In your HPA axis, which two are functioning in Addison's disease would be your adrenals are not working, autoimmune destruction of your adrenal glands. So it's your hypothalamus with corticotropin releasing hormone and your anterior pituitary that's producing ACTH. Question number 9, see if your memory is any good. In what part of the pituitary is ACTH produced? Question number 9, in what part of the pituitary is ACTH produced? The answer to question number 9 is, of course, just mentioned it, the anterior pituitary gland. Remember that oxytocin, an antidiuretic hormone, are produced in the posterior pituitary gland. But many other things, including TSH, luteinizing hormone, follicle stimulating hormone, and of course our friend ACTH, are all produced in the anterior pituitary gland. Question number 10 and our final question of today, which of the following is not a counter-regulatory hormone? So I'm going to list 5 as the best of 5. A, glucagon. B, growth hormone. C, cortisol. D, dopamine. Or E, adrenaline. Which of the following is not a counter-regulatory hormone? Would be dopamine. So dopamine is a catecholamine, but is not a counter-regulatory hormone that opposes glucose. Glucagon, growth hormone, cortisol and adrenaline all increase your blood glucose levels and are therefore counter-regulatory hormones. Thank you very much for tuning into this quiz. Hope you've learned a few things. And the purpose of this quiz was just to assess how much you're learning. Thank you very much.